In working with the Four Noble Truths, to understand, especially to have understood suffering, does the Buddha mean knowing, for example, pain in your heart, stress around your eyes, or does he also mean to see with insight its karmic effect on yourself and others? it's much, much deeper, and sort of that and much more, really. Understanding of dukkha is the limitations, the difficulty, the stress, and it's a template for investigation and practice that allows us to have a deeper insight into the nature of self and the world, and freedom from the world, and freedom from self. There's many, many implications that arise in that penetration of dukkha. Also, it's helpful to know that, say, just the word dukkha, we translate it as suffering, and you think, oh, it's really, it's something that is has to be pretty extreme before it's dukkha. But it's pretty ordinary. The word dukkha in the Northern Indian language is an ancient word, dukkha and sukha. Sukha, as they normally say, dukkha is suffering, sukha is happiness. But duk and su is sort of like, duk is sort of not good, and su is good. But ka is the Northern Indian culture was a horse culture, so that the ka was the where the axle and the wheel fit together. So like dukkha is when it doesn't fit, and the wheel doesn't roll. It doesn't. It's not smooth. It's not comfortable. It's suffering. But when sukha is, when that axle and that wheel actually really fit together, and it just rolls smoothly. Everything's you're happy. And then the second question, to abandon the cause, does it mean in that moment or completely? So if the story in Kilesa keeps coming back and coming back and coming back, have you not fulfilled the edict to know it has been abandoned, even though you bear with it and appear to have abandoned it momentarily? Yeah, I mean, it's a radical relinquishment of the defilements, the kilesas. Sometimes the story is there, but it's just a story. You see it as it's just a story, so you don't have to believe it. You don't have to, you still have memory. Still remember things, but it's you have a very different relationship with it, so that it can be completely abandoned. Okay, thank you for sharing the stories in the morning. All the stories made me realize the fact that we are seeking, what we are seeking is just right here in quote-unquote our mind. What do you think? Yeah, absolutely. that seeking for some kind of external. Of course, I mean, when real there's the supports and the teachings and the places, and we have to rely on that. But in the end, we have to come back to our own minds. It's like, as an example, Ajahn Sumedho, when he was a young monk, went with Ajahn Chah and another senior disciple of Ajahn Chah. The three of them went up into the northern part of the northeast and visited paid respects to many of the disciples of Ajahn Mun. One of them that they went to visit was Lopu Khao, and he ordained in later life, and then so that by the time and he trained with Ajahn Mun, studied with him. Ajahn Mun passed away, and this is years after Ajahn Mun passed away. So that Lumpu Kha was pretty old and at that time. And he spoke, originally he's from Ubon, and he spoke a really thick accent. And of course, he's chewing betel nut the whole time. And Ajahn Sumedho couldn't follow at all what they were talking about. And Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Mahamon, the disciple of Ajahn Chah, they spent quite a bit of time with Lumpu Khao, and they had this very animated and warm exchange back and forth. And Ajahn Sumedho was just sort of waiting for it to be over. Because you just couldn't follow it. It was really hard. And, you know, he delighted in the fact of being there, but still it was. So that anyway, they Ajahn Chah and they all took leave of Lumpu Khao, and then Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Mahamon went sort of out the door to leaving, and then Ajahn Sumedho was waiting for them to go out first, so then he was there on his own for just a second. And Lumpu Khao kind of jumped up and went over to Ajahn Sumedho, and he said, in just very, very simple Thai, "It's all here. It's all here." So, could you talk more about the two levels of understanding, true nature of karma, one mundane level? This is actually a what it is there's the two aspects of right understanding. So that the first aspect of say sammāditti, of right view on the Eightfold Path, is that looking at it in terms of karma, in the sense that there is action, there is the results of action, there is good, there is that which is not good, there is the fruits of one's there is the fruits of offering and generosity, there are beings who are spontaneously reborn. There is this world, there is the next world, there is religious seekers who have understood the true nature of things. Let's say on a mundane level, and it's on the level of beings. And then the transcendent level is the Four Noble Truths, so that the Buddha, they say, to be able to have the right understanding that is liberating, then we step maybe beyond the sense of say, me and others, or the world and beings, and we're looking at phenomena that arise and cease, that is an opportunity to step out of the and even step beyond the the causal processes to the unconditioned. There's a very well-known phrase that was used as a book title in Thai for one of Ajahn Chah's books, which is Nok Het Nupol, which is sort of like outside of cause, beyond effect, outside of suffering, beyond happiness. Sort of that, but that this is something that is okay. This is a transcendent level, an unconditioned level. Competitiveness feels so pervasive here in America. What are your thoughts for working with it or healing it? I think just this, the most important thing is seeing suffering in it, and that sense of understanding how painful it is to be kind of competitive, driving, pushing, comparing, the elevation of, sorry, the lifting up of self, and then kind of having to measure oneself all the time. And that, which is, you know, very ego-driven. I was at tea time, I was with the monks, I was quoting a well-known modern American philosopher, Donald Trump. And it was, you know, show me someone without an ego and I'll show you a loser. There's your sort of American competitiveness. And look where it's got. Just really recognizing the pain in that. That's such an important tool for both understanding and relinquishment, because that's what motivates us when we see, oh, that's really painful. But it is something that's quite ingrained in the culture from early years of America's history. It's been about kind of expansion. It's been about competing for resources. It's been about gaining and accruing, and that. I remember there's a Canadian writer who once wrote that that American drive to gain, to succeed, to expand, to control is very much a part of the history of America and what is created it. And said in Canada, all that they wanted to do was just survive a winter. Yeah, which is really helpful. That's a very different perspective. There was always possibilities in America, and so it was land of opportunity. But it has an effect. Competitiveness and drive, and one reaps the effects of cultural values. So it's important to have a perspective, and that's what it's like. Oh, and that's what it feels like. And then you realize, it's actually that can be worked with. Oftentimes what that say that competitiveness comes to is where we compare ourselves to others, and of course from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha pointed to an area of so there are three particular things that proliferate the mind, so. Tanha, so desire, ditti, views, sort of views, opinions, and mana is usually translated as conceit. So those are they're called papancha dhammas. So that those three forces in the mind that proliferate it, keep it moving, and. And mana as conceit, say in the English language, when you use the word conceit, then it's usually, you lift yourself up and look down on others. But from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha said there's nine different bases of conceit, being inferior and assuming oneself to be inferior, being inferior, assuming oneself to be equal, being inferior, assuming oneself to be superior, being equal, assuming oneself to be inferior, being equal, assuming oneself to be equal, being equal, assuming oneself to be superior, being superior, assuming oneself to be inferior, being superior, assuming oneself to be equal, being superior, and assuming oneself to be superior. All of those nine bases are what are the nine bases of conceit. So it's around that comparing and trying to find a place where what am I? I must be somewhere. I must be better. I must be worse. I must be equal. And but that's a comparing, and there's a competitive edge there. So that keeps bringing the one to a place of suffering. So being able to put that comparing down, and it's a, just opens up a place of non-suffering. Could you describe the progression of Anagarika and Samanera training? Much gratitude. For an Anagarika, they would come to the monastery, spend some time, and usually a couple visits maybe, and then come and spend a few months, and then if they look like they're sincere, want to take on the training, then to take the Anagarika precepts, which are 8 precepts, wearing white as Anagarika Armand is doing, and which sometimes white. It's a real burden having white. And that training as an Anagarika in white would be 1 year. So they would follow the training in the monastery, fit into the community, see how it's going, see if they survive to the end of the year. And then if they want to continue training, then they would request to take the Samanera training or novice training, which is they wear brown, but it's far fewer precepts. So 10 precepts, which are the big difference between the 8 and the 10 precepts is that you're relinquishing the use of money. That changes your life. But then, in effect, also what taking on the novice training is that they say wouldn't be driving anymore, not be in the kitchen, so stepping back from cooking. So that sort of having more focus on the more monastic aspect of the training. Still, following the routines in the monastery and fitting in with the community, helping out. And then at the end of another year, then if they want to go forward and take on the bhikkhu training, the monk's training, then they would request that. And they could... And each of those processes, we would discuss it in the community. Is this person wants to be an Anagarika? Do we want to take them on? So it'd be a communal decision. This person's been an Anagarika. He wants to be a novice. How's it going? Because it's... they'll come and ask permission from me, but they're always on their best behavior in front of me. So I have to go, well, how's it going with the others? And then once they take the monk's training, then that's a commitment for 5 years. Staying with the teacher, staying, taking on the we're looking, 5 years of monastic training as a bhikkhu, which doesn't mean they would be at a Bhai Giri all the time. but it would be under my guidance, our guidance as senior monks. Oftentimes we'll have, especially maybe the third year of their training, go to one of the branch monasteries in our community, whether it's in Thailand or England or Canada, or a place that I feel comfortable with, that they'll continue their training. And then after 5 years, oftentimes that's a time where they're going to spread their wings and find places of either maybe study with other teachers or take the opportunity to practice in solitude. So that's how a progression kind of works in our communities. Okay, the middle way. It is not 50% becoming and 50% annihilation, right? What is it the middle of? It's the middle of suffering. In a sense that it's in the middle where there is no suffering. That's the middle way. Toward the end of this morning sitting meditation, my body started shaking from left to right for about a minute or so. While this was happening, I was observing it without getting panicked or trying to stop it, and then it stopped shaking. How do you explain this experience? Well, it arose and it passed away. but a lot... I think a lot of it is, you know, that just by not getting in a panic and observing, being present with it, because you know sometimes different things, you know, whether it's mentally or physically, you know, things arise in the mind, and just to be able to be present with it, to be mindful, to be alert, to not be fearful, not be... Because sometimes we go, you know, what does this mean? And then we can spin out on it, and of course it keeps things agitated and stirred up. So it says, oh, okay, this is what it feels like. Oh, it's like this. And then there's a certain relaxation and clarity that's there. And the... the inclination, a natural inclination, would be to come back to a sense of well-being. In this afternoon's talk, Ajahn Kurundamo mentioned the benefits of the bhava that results from practice or the Eightfold Path. This is not verbatim, but he described a consciousness that doesn't land in or on self, a consciousness that doesn't give rise to self and results in freedom. Is that a consciousness that results in neither arising or non-arising, neither bhava or vibhava? Could... you elaborate on this, or could he? The moment between in and out breath seems to hold potential for this kind of consciousness. Do you want to answer?
My consciousness just landed somewhere.
Right, one of the things is just to recognize that the sense of as soon as you try to define it too tightly, you immediately you set yourself up for limitation, Because a lot of the language that we use, especially when it starts coming to experiences like this, you're just trying to point towards or trying to get people to feel what would that feel like? There is consciousness that it's neither say arising or non-arising, but I've been trying to define it too tightly, then you end up tying yourself in a knot. The Buddha himself, there's rare cases because the Buddha is a very practical teacher. It's like he's given you the tools in order for you to experience for yourself. And in a few places, the Buddha speaks or alludes to the results. And consciousness that luminous all around and not settling on a place. So the Buddha used language like that. And there are places where the Buddha kind of points to that, but it gives a lot more encouragement to pay attention to how to get there, something like okay, there's a moment in between in and out breaths is a really good way of experimenting or prodding the mind to what would it feel like to, because there's a natural setting physiologically, and what does the mind do with that? Because it looks for something else to do, and so then experiment. How can I just be with that? The Buddha also uses an image of the that consciousness not landing. The sun coming through the window and striking the western wall of and the Buddha, what if there were no western wall? Where would it land? Well, it would land. What if there were no floor? What if there were nothing? It wouldn't land. It opens into space. But these are just ways of trying to get us to relinquish or to experiment with relinquishing the. You know, where does consciousness keep landing? Because it keeps landing on I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like, I should, I shouldn't. It's so much of the I process and the desire process. So then recognize, oh yeah, that's. Can I release that? Can I relinquish that? And then paying attention to the feeling that arises, because it opens up possibilities of real spaciousness and peace. It can also open up possibilities of we start. Clamping down and trying to define it, and it gets I should be experiencing something. There's that compulsion. So where is that coming from? Because oftentimes there's fear of letting go. So to be alert to these processes. And that's why just these Four Noble Truths of dukkha, that you want to pay attention to the experience, say, rather than the idea about it. There's actually another question on the consciousness that doesn't land. Did the Buddha perform any miracles? He did. And he talked about them sometimes. And say the different types of psychic powers were accessible to the Buddha, but then in one discourse, the greatest miracle is being able to teach the Dhamma and to give the opportunity for somebody to have right view arise. That's a real miracle. Can the monastics speak about the skillful use of caffeine for their practice? Caffeine makes me more productive in daily work, but I've also noticed a lot of the quote-unquote becoming energy. It depends on, any given monastery, there'll be those who drink coffee or tea, and there'll be those who don't. Some people find it too agitating, too stimulating. And then you just have to pay attention to what it does to the mind, does to the body as well, because sometimes it's there's energy comes up, but then it's hard to settle it. And different constitutions are different. Say for myself, I've gone through periods where I didn't take caffeine, but mostly these days, I love my tea in the morning, but then tend to, once it gets later in the day, I might have a cup of green tea. It's not so stimulating, but for some people, that's even too much, somebody like Ajahn Sumedho, he's over 80 and he's still, I don't know how many cups of coffee he drinks a day. I mean, it's just, it's astounding. I don't know anybody who can keep up with him. Right? It's just this different constitutions. Thank you to everyone who shared their personal journeys with us this morning. It was just the right mixture of nutriments to brighten the mind, poignancy, vulnerability, transparency, and good humor. What a gift for the whole Sangha. Very nice. Okay, thank you for all your clear teachings. Can you please explain the asavas? Asava is it's a root defilement, fundamental defilement that keeps pulling us back to rebirth, to suffering, to difficulty, and asava is a curious word. Because sometimes it's translated as outflows, in the sense of that which kind of flows out to the world, so that the kind of a stain within the heart that then moves out to the world. But sometimes it's translated as an inflow, that something that comes into the mind to stain it. I'm not a Pali scholar, and Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as a taint, so that something that's stained. What the heck does Ajahn Jeff translate it as?
Effluence.
Effluence, so that has that outflow.
Also fermentation.
Fermentations is another one. Yeah, so those are the old translation. One of the earliest translations was canker. It was like a sore that's oozing. So that's that has that illusion. So that, but the these root kind of defilements are the asava of sensuality, gam asava, so that sensuality, gratification of desire, bhava asava, so the asava of becoming a being, seeking that identity, and then avijasava, the taint of ignorance or lack of true knowledge. Avijja is lack of true knowledge, not understanding the true nature of things. So those are the, and in later teachings. In the early commentarial literature, they added dittahasava, so that the asava of view, of views, opinions, so that it was seen as something that fundamental to staining the mind. Older layers of the suttas, or where that would be folded into to the others. Your reminder of mudita to open to others' happiness brings another word appropriate for this day, katanyu. Please speak a little on this. Many here have performed small acts of great kindness. Gratitude. So, katanyu is gratitude, and it's actually one of the qualities that the Buddha points to as a sort of like a defining quality of a proper human being. Somebody is fully human when they have gratitude and reciprocate gratitude, because there's two words, katanyu and kataweti. Katanyu is the feeling of gratitude. Katavaiti is the reciprocation of gratitude, acting on that gratitude. And those two qualities are something that the Buddha elevates to something that's an important aspect of living a human life. Because we live together in community, we live together with others, and to be attentive to each other's needs and to be helpful to each other. This is a sense of gratitude, and then recognizing the good that's been done. And this is where also a strong part of Buddhist culture, Buddhist traditions, will out of gratitude or out of concern, we'll do dedications of merit, dedications of blessings, as an expression of gratitude, so that dedicating the goodness that is comes from one's actions, an act of gratitude, or when we, like in the chant, when we dedicate blessings that arise from our practice, our wholesome acts, deeds. One makes a dedication to all beings, whether they're those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile. Allow the heart to open, and out of a sense of gratitude, so there's many aspects of gratitude. There's a this quite a few years ago. Ajahn Liam, who's the current abbot of Wat Bopong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. He was Ajahn Chah's successor. And by temperament, he's not a... he's definitely not a schmoozer. For those who have met him, he's... I think he'd be quite aloof, sometimes he's difficult to read, because he's just one. He's very quiet, but he's an excellent teacher, and he gives himself to helping others all the time. But he came and stayed about a month. This is because it's quite a few years ago. It was about a month with us at Abhayagiri. And then when he was leaving, one of the ways that we in a monastic protocol and ceremony, we take leave of him and ask forgiveness from him as a way of paying respects, and he gave us a gift, and it was a handwritten little essay that he'd written in his spare time while he was visiting on gratitude. It's just really touching. It's a quality that elevates the heart to recognize our connection with each other as human beings and as beings that exist together on the planet. This retreat has greatly reinforced my gratitude for this birth and for my ability to practice the Dhamma. Especially as I am aging, I feel more of an urgency to awaken. Unfortunately, I live in a small town on the central coast, and there are no Buddhist centers within hundreds of miles. How can I continue to deepen my practice in the absence of a living teacher? I think one of the great benefits of, say, the modern age, modern technology, is the amount of Dhamma that's available online, both in terms of there's tons of YouTube videos one can watch. I don't think I've got lots in the Thai language on YouTube. I don't think there's anything in English. There are lots of other teachers, Ajahn Jayasaro, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Sumedho, I assume. I don't look for these things. There's got to be lots and on video, audio. There's so much audio available. Forest Sangha Publications is our own community that has a lot of audio of all the various teachers, as well as written publications. So there's lots of books that can be either requested from different places, from Baigiri. We do book mailing. Here's our couple book mailers here. Ing and Hisayo come every second week and do book mailing. Or they're online, they're EPUB, MOBI, PDFs, things to be that could be read. So there's lots of material available, and I think one of the things that a Baigiri website. Usually, whatever Dhamma talks are given, within 24 hours, they're up online. And then sometimes knowing the monastic schedule, sometimes plugging in to the that chanting meditations taking place at 7 o'clock at the monastery in the evening or in the morning, and synchronize your routine with that, knowing that it's the monastery is keeping this rhythm going in its life, and plugging in with that. So there's many ways of plugging in from a distance. And I'm sure there's all sorts of other things. I mean, there's meditation groups that meditate together like cyber, you know, in cyberspace. I mean, it's just synchronizing. So it's something that there used to be a group that did the lunar observances, kind of scattered around the country, and check in with each other at 9 o'clock at night, check in again at midnight, and what's happening, check in again later at night through the doing the lunar observances. And so that there are many, many ways of doing it. That's the say the benefits of modern technology. Okay, there's a question about contemplating, investigating consciousness and feeling tone, I'll do a bit of a make it a bit briefer, but seeing that there's say consciousness seemed to be arising just at one sense door at a time, and that trying with say like with sight and sound, and so with only one consciousness felt at one moment, wasn't sure of its usefulness. But it's actually the way that that's actually how consciousness works. It just arises and ceases. It's not as if it's all happening at once. We can only experience one consciousness at a time, one mind moment at a time. And they happen very quickly, sometimes you hone in on some of that arising and ceasing, and realize how there's a continuum, but it's arising and ceasing very quickly, Yeah, I mean, is it useful? Yes, of course, it is useful because it's the way it is. But then it's also having to pay attention to the that feeling tone of things, because the mind, it's like in the question, is sort of there's drowsiness took over and noted. Became aware of it, consciousness feeling the unpleasant feeling. The mind is restless because of the desire for it not to be there. And in looking at that, you know, one sees the much of we're reacting, and oftentimes we don't even notice it because we're caught in it. It seems so. We have to be willing to investigate from a perspective of, is this skillful? Is it not skillful? Is it wholesome? Is it not wholesome? And this is because sometimes we can experiencing things in a a very refined way or a very minute way, but on a broader perspective, from the context of practicing Dhamma, the Buddha has us reflect and understand, say, the nature and the implications of our experience, so that let's say a classification of experience, that's quite fundamental to our practice and the Buddhist perspective, is understanding, is in scriptural language, kusala and akusala. Kusala is wholesome, skillful. Akusala is unwholesome, unskillful. And there's a constellation of experience that is a part of that, so that, say, on a feeling tone or experience, the akusala is, it's unpleasant, it's painful, uncomfortable, whereas kusala is it's always going to be comfortable, it's going to be pleasant. In terms of the how it manifests, akusala, there's always an element of restlessness or agitation there. It's the nature of the mind that is bound by the habit of what is unskillful or unwholesome. And the kusala is always going to be, it's experienced as peaceful, as clear. Mind is clear, heart is clear. Content is, say, of the, let's say, akusala, it's always going to be associated with some form, manifestation of greed, hatred, and delusion. Whereas kusala, the wholesome, it's bound up with generosity, with kindness, with compassion. Because those are wisdom, discernment. Those are content. It's broad brush way of investigating the mind. But it's very helpful to have a, all right, this is, because sometimes we can, something might be manifesting itself as so and so is just a pain in the butt, and they've got they really should be set straight. But then you sort of pay, okay, it just seems really clear, intelligent assessment of the situation. But if you pay attention, it's the mind's agitated, and really it's restless. It can't wait to say, and say, no, that's an akusala condition. This is so that you sort of pay attention to the clues and say, oh no, this is kusala, this is akusala, this is skillful, this is unskillful. Learning how these manifest in different ways. In Hinduism, there's a belief that we choose our parents in order to work through some karma. Is there a similar belief in Buddhism? How much volition can we exert over future rebirths, if any? Well, I mean, we're exerting it all the time. I mean, that's actually, we're doing it right now. Our future births are being set in motion by the volitions that we build up as our habit, our perceptions are. So the process is, and we don't have to wait until this body dies to see the fruits of rebirth, and rebirth is it's happening all the time. We're being, say, reborn in different, with different moods and perceptions and ideas, and so that recognizing that we're contributing to the process right now, and we can exercise wisdom, we can exercise mindfulness, we can exercise restraint, we can exercise compassion, we can exercise loving kindness. So that those are the sort of things we get reborn, the conditions we get reborn into, so that we build up that momentum. But also I remember Ajahn Chah saying one time that especially with the rebirth process, that somebody gets reborn, they're going to get reborn somewhere where they have some kind of familiarity, connection. It's just the way the mind works. I mean, if you're, it's pretty rare that we decide to go somewhere where we know nobody, we know nothing about it. We don't. That's not the way the mind works. There's some kind of attraction. There's some kind of affinity. There's some kind of association that's built up. That's where we move towards. So that happens in daily life. What happens in daily life, same thing happens when we die. The process just keeps on going. Okay. Got through the questions today. We'll have a bit of a break and come back for puja.